discussing the ideas, the challenges, and the technology of the crypto economy. This is a Crypto Economy Chat. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. This is The Crypto Economy with Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And being an avid reader of all things Bitcoin, I have got literally my favorite writer of Bitcoin things on the show today. We've got an awesome conversation with Aaron Van Verdam, longtime Bitcoin OG and a writer for, well, multiple publications, really, but most notably Bitcoin Magazine. On that, if you have not gotten your copy of the recent print magazine, the 10th anniversary edition, you can still get it at the Bitcoin store, Bitcoin Magazine store. I will drop the link in the show notes. And there are a lot of great articles by Aaron in that magazine of all kinds of topics. So it is genuinely one not to be missed. But we got into all kinds of fun shit in this episode. Talked with Aaron about his background and, you know, what pulled him into Bitcoin. What did he do before? We talk about his process and figuring out how to understand incredibly complex technologies when starting from basically zero, about the growing need for privacy and all the really exciting tech coming to Bitcoin because he's written about so much of it. And we get into the social impacts of paradigm-shifting technologies, Bitcoin being obviously the most pertinent example, but even things like the printing press and technology throughout history. So I really hope you guys enjoy this as much as I did, and we won't delay any longer. Let's just go ahead and jump right into our conversation, our crypto chat with Aaron Van Verdam.
I try. All right. Well, Aaron, it's really awesome to have you on the show. Truly, I have been following your stuff for, I don't know, what have you been writing since 2013, maybe?
Yeah, in 2013 it was Dutch, so unless you can read Dutch, you probably weren't reading my stuff back then. I wrote a couple of articles in Dutch then. I think my first article in English was for Bitcoin Magazine, actually, and that was probably around March 2014, something like that.
Okay. Yeah. I feel like it was really early on, because I had been...
It was early 2014.
Okay. And you started off right with, I know you wrote for, well, I guess you were freelance and you wrote for like other places like Cointelegraph or some other places like that, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Yeah. Also CoinDesk. There was something called BitPost I wrote for a little bit, but I wrote quite a lot for Cointelegraph for a while. I think late 2014, early 2015, I was sort of actually working for them like on a full-time basis as well. And then after that, I went back to Bitcoin Magazine. So that was summer, autumn 2015, and I've been with them ever since.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. You've been, I remember because it was always anytime back then, it was hard to find good writing. It just was you were kind of a diamond in the rough, right when I bumped into your name. And it was funny. I don't remember exactly what the second article that I read of yours was, but I was like, okay, this guy's actually writes stuff. But I've always been curious just kind of what your background was. How did you get into Bitcoin? What was it in 2013 that pushed you there? Have you been writing for, is that what you were doing before then? Or
yeah, pretty much. Well, I studied journalism. So that's one thing. Just here in the Netherlands, in Utrecht. And I did a master's after that, also here in Utrecht, which was nothing. It has nothing to do with technology even, or, well, a little bit with technology, but I'm definitely not a developer or anything like that. Some people think that. I studied politics and society in historical perspective, and I focused a lot on how, for example, the printing press sort of affected society And I think that's kind of a parallel I saw with, well, with the internet at first, and then when Bitcoin came along, that seemed like another, you know, technology that could sort of have a real effect on how society actually functions. That got me interested. It was also, well, your question was I writing? So yeah, I was writing as a freelance journalist, but in Dutch. And I was, you know, doing internships and that kind of stuff. So there, but all in Dutch. This was all in Dutch.
Gotcha. So your piece on the impact of the printing press is in Dutch?
That was for my master's, and it may have actually been in English, with the stuff I wrote for it, but that's not published or anything. It's just,
you should publish it or send it to me. I'd love to read it. That actually sounds really interesting. Like, I love exactly that kind of topic. Like what kind of social impact does like a major technology have? Because I think it's kind of like in the traditional like education or thinking, we forget how much, or it's like, it's not focused on like in school, I learned who the president was then, you know, like not what the printing press did. And
right.
I feel like the printing press had orders of magnitude more impact than any, like who cares who's the president right?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I don't know. I absolutely love that kind of stuff. So yeah, if you were.
Yeah, I did kind of a research project, for example, on where I compared how the printing press affected sort of North America versus South America, Latin America. And in Latin America, it was much more restricted. Like it was really, they really kept the printing press out of the hands of the common people, basically, while in North America, it became a much more common thing where there were printing presses in town that people could use. And that had a huge effect. You may have heard of the Federalist Papers, for example. That was all like printed, and they used the printing press to spread these ideas of democracy, and that, you know, that had an effect that echoes through the centuries, literally. Like even centuries later, the United States was much more democratic than a lot of Latin American countries, and I think that definitely originates from that kind of these kinds of technology and how they spread through society.
Wow, that's really fascinating. I mean. That's kind of a proof right there, is that like we're talking about the Federalist Papers because everybody pretty much knows or has heard of it. And that's a powerful indication of what that printing press meant, like as being available during that time, is that that idea could spread.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm legit. Like if you have a copy of that and you wanted to publish it, I would be absolutely jacked. I'd love to read it.
I'll have to see if I still have it. Probably still have it. I mean, it's got to be 2 laptops ago when I wrote that. I probably still have it somewhere. I'd have to look it up. Yeah. So, and then in 2013, when Bitcoin came along, I was, one of the things I was kind of writing about, or at least it had my attention, was just the whole financial sector and how they messed it all up, So one of the sort of common themes, at least here in the Netherlands, and I think it may have been a bit different in the United States, or at least, well, I guess someone like Elizabeth Warren has a sort of similar approach, where the main calls for change were in the direction of more regulation, like banks had to be regulated more, and that was sort of the common theme. And then when I heard of Bitcoin, it was such a radically different answer. Like, why do we even need banks? Like, let's do money without banks. And that's such a fascinating concept that struck me immediately. And I wanted to know more about it and read more about it. And then Bitcoin hit the mainstream news because there was a bubble. And then the only thing you would read in the mainstream news was this very different take on it. Like it's, you know, it's a bubble, it's criminals' money. It was such a negative approach, where I discovered Bitcoin like 2 months before it really hit the mainstream in 2013. And I was seeing something so different. Like, why don't they see the potential here? Why don't they see how interesting this concept is. And that really triggered me to start writing about it. And I started writing a series of blog posts, just in Dutch, where I kind of dismissed, or I kind of refuted or gave the counter arguments for everything I was reading, like why Bitcoin isn't a Ponzi scheme, why it's not only for criminals. And that was how I started.
Awesome. It's funny, like I probably had a similar response, like when they were in that whole push of like the whole narrative was like, oh, we need more regulation to fix this giant systemic problem that has come to a head. It was just like, it seems so arbitrary to me. It's like the regulation, look what the regulation already failed to fix. Like this is, you know, this isn't a small, this is a multi-trillion dollar disaster here. And like this went, this supposedly went under everybody's nose. And like this is your failure, you know, like we need something really different. Like we need something to turn, like how could that kind of imbalance actually happen? Like, where is the disconnect between the real resources and all the numbers that you fools are pushing around over there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think at that point, I kind of accepted the narrative, actually. I kind of accepted the narrative that more regulation was needed until I...
Really?
Yeah, I think that was sort of... I kind of went along in that line of reasoning, and Bitcoin really changed my mind. Bitcoin really showed me such a radical different solution, and mm-hmm. it really got me thinking that, wait a minute, maybe more regulation isn't the answer here. Maybe less regulation is what we actually need. Maybe the whole system of, you know, deposit insurance, maybe that's the problem, really, if you think about it. And, I still think that way. So Bitcoin really showed me a different, completely different solution to the same problem. And it really blew my mind for a while there.
That's fascinating. Bitcoin is such a, that's one of those things about Bitcoin that I constantly harp on, is just the fact that it is kind of that, it's that black swan that like pokes its head in and like it makes everybody readjust. Like it's so different from the norm that it's incredibly good at poking holes in people's like ideas of what's possible or like perspectives on how to think about or like fix a thing, you know?
It's a paradigm shift. At least if it continues to succeed, it's just a complete paradigm shift. It just turns everything upside down.
Yeah, it really does. And I think there's no going back, at least fingers crossed. That's my conviction right now. That's what I'm going for, is that like we're in this, and I mean, it's invented. So I really think there isn't any going back. I just hope we don't have to start from scratch again. I hope Bitcoin doesn't break in this process. That would make me very sad. But
so far, so good.
So far, so good. That's right. So, how do you like working for Bitcoin Magazine? You're with them full time, and are they just a bunch of assholes? Or
I'm actually not full time with them at this point. I kind of took a step back. But no, it's a great.
Oh, okay.
David Bailey is the CEO, and he's like the biggest Bitcoin minded guy out there. Like he's a huge Bitcoin enthusiast, and that really trickles down into the whole company. I think it's really a fun, interesting Bitcoin focused company where everyone's thinking about, you know, how, not just about how can we grow this company and how can we make money, but also I think really how can we help Bitcoin, or what can we do for Bitcoin, or what kind of role can we play here as a company? I think that's very interesting. I will say I don't work from their office. I've only been there once. I work remote, you know, I'm in Europe. So I don't experience it every day, but I've been there. And sometimes I meet the team at other events. Like recently we had our San Francisco event, of course, Bitcoin 2019. Or I'll meet them at the New York Blockchain Week or so. So I'm not there every day, but I still, it's an interesting company to work for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I ended up meeting like I don't know, I feel like 10, 15 people like sitting down chatting with guys who worked at Bitcoin Magazine, and everybody I met was just like, so like, and it was really exciting just at the Bitcoin 2019 conference because everybody was all giddy because, you know, it was working. I'm sure it was like a sort of relief to actually have it happening, you know, after all the buildup and how busy I'm sure all those guys were. But I've been excited about, like, then Bitcoin Magazine was like, just when it was announced, like, that there was going to be like a physical magazine, like I nerded, like, fanboyed out so hard back in the day. I mean, like, it was just the coolest thing in the world. I've always wanted. I've got two copies of the new magazine, but I don't have one that's not open, so I still haven't done that. I should probably just go ahead and do that today. I need to buy my 10th anniversary edition unopened. Right. I got to get my collector's edition.
Yeah, it came together quite nicely. I think it looks great.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. It looked really good. And I loved your articles in it. I still am not all the way through it. I'm about halfway through the thing.
Right.
But your, the intro articles about like the history of the cypherpunks and then like Satoshi and like the precursors to Bitcoin. Great stuff. Great stuff. It's really in line with, the Genesis Files series, which is one of my favorite of yours.
Cool.
So, do you get paid fully in Bitcoin? Do you do all your stuff in Bitcoin?
Yeah, well, it goes through Bitwage, so I can choose. But I choose it.
See, you have Bitwage, dude. I don't think that's I don't think they can do that in the U.S. Can they do that in the U.S.?
I think so.
Really?
I think so. I don't know.
I need to check into that. Oh, I definitely need to look into that. I thought that wasn't available in the U.S. Ooh. Anyway.
That would surprise me, but I don't know. I'm not from the U.S. I haven't experienced it.
Gotcha.
Definitely work here.
Yeah. how did Bitcoin Magazine come to you, or did you reach out to them? Like, how did that whole thing happen back in the day?
I reached out to them at first. I was working for Cointelegraph for a while, and then that kind of ended. And so I was just looking for work, and I reached out to them. And I think I wrote maybe. Let's see. I wrote a couple of articles for Bitcoin Magazine just on a freelance basis around that time, and then the Scaling Bitcoin conference happened in Montreal, which was that was September, I think, and that's where I met David and a couple of other people from Bitcoin Magazine, and they basically offered me a job right there, I believe.
Oh wow.
I think they just told me you should come work for us, like, you know, on a steady basis. Like, early in Montreal, where they offered me.
So I really, nice.
I recall.
Who all was how different is it, like how big were they back then? Like how many was the crew? Like how many other people were you writing with back then versus now? Like, is it?
Oh, they were just starting because it used to be owned by Vitalik and Mihai, and that was there was a whole other team working on it,
mm-hmm.
and they just closed shop, I don't know, maybe early 2015 or something.
Yeah, right, when they were switching over to Ethereum, I guess.
Yeah, and then BTC Media, as it was called, then today's called BTC Inc., they bought Bitcoin Magazine, and they restarted it, I think, in summer of 2015. So they were only just getting going when I reached out to them, I think. Maybe only 2 months or so, and it was a super small team at that time.
Interesting. Okay. Excited to have the magazine back in print.
Well, for now it was a one-time thing, but we're gonna do another one for sure at the next conference. But it's not gonna be like a monthly thing, if that's what you're hoping for. At least, we might at some point decide we want to do that, but we haven't yet. Like, for now, that's not the case. We're just gonna
do another one
when the next conference is up. I think I like it that way. I prefer online on a more regular basis, just because mm-hmm. you have to reach, like, everyone in the world can read it, and that I kind of prefer it that way. And a print magazine has something special, but if you do one every month, it's not as special anymore. So I don't know if I would. Really be, I would probably be against that, or I don't know. Maybe I could be convinced otherwise. But I don't really have special feelings for print, to be perfectly honest with you. I like digital just as much.
I like the novelty of it. And yeah, but with the print, like I definitely kind of agree. Like the, I guess you could say the scarcity really gives it its value. And when I talked to Jeremy Fleming, because I talked to him a lot about the magazine and everything, and he was saying that basically what you were saying is that it's probably going to be like kind of an annual thing ish.
Yeah. You mean Andrew Fleming? Yeah.
I mean, I guess, excuse me. Yes, Andrew. Sorry. And I think that's a great decision, but just because you don't want to fill it with like just the general like news stuff, you know, like you want to be like the good stuff like gets put in print. And I totally agree. I like for just keeping up with it, like just I'll just read all the stuff on Bitcoin Magazine and follow it online. But I like to have that every year that Bitcoin stays and Bitcoin continues to grow. Let me get my Bitcoin Magazine and stash it away in my collector's pile.
Yeah, and then an annual edition sounds like a interesting and good idea too.
On that, do you basically get to choose like what you write about, or do you just you go hunting for stuff and they're like, oh, love it, like and like take your stuff, or do they usually end up kind of sending you like these are the new technologies, like check these out? Like how does that work exactly?
No, that would be me usually. I pick my own stories, yeah. I think they're very, yeah, once in a while there will be a suggestion from someone else on something I should write, but that's more the exception. I usually pick my own stories and find what I think is interesting or what hasn't been reported yet, or yeah, that would be me most of the case.
Yeah, I love the one on state chains recently. I've gotten to where I really like legit like depend on, because I don't have the time much. Like I end up reading so much stuff and I have such a backlog constantly that now I kind of lean on your stuff, particularly when you have any of the technical things, because right. you always have the simplified version, you know, like instead of me doing 2 hours of research, I read a 15 minute article and I feel like I got a really good idea of exactly how it works. So I really, really appreciate those in particular.
Good. Yeah, you read that one on your show, I think, right? Yeah, you did.
Yeah, just this Monday, yeah. Just 2 days ago. Yeah, no. Really good one. I love that one.
Cool.
When you, what's kind of your process when you're breaking into the new technology, state chains being a great example, or the no input scripts, like that one, I had a hard time trying to, and particularly because there's like two or three or four or something even that are in, I guess, discussion or whatnot. Like where do you start trying to break this stuff down? You say you're not a developer, right? But you have some sort of technical background? Like,
nope.
Is no, not none at all?
None at all.
Just investigating. That's you're just good at figuring out how the hell things work.
Well, usually I mean, you ask where I start. Well, I start with just reading the BIP or the mailing list, and if there is a presentation available, I'll definitely watch that. And then usually after I've done these things, then I still don't get it, or I kind of have an idea of how it works, but not really, not like I could write it down yet.
Yeah, yeah.
So then I reach out to the people working on it, or the whoever designed it or whoever invented it. So that was Ruben Thompson for the state chain article, or Christian Decker for the no input article, or you know, whoever is working on it. And then I start asking them dumb questions, and they usually have the patience to answer them for me until I actually understand what's going on. So usually I do my first research, like I mentioned, just reading the BIP, and then I have kind of a clue of how it works, and I usually try to explain it to them. Like I try explaining to them how their technology works, and then ask them to correct me wherever I'm wrong, and then or until the point where I kind of reach a dead end and I'm like, okay, this part I guess I don't understand, so can you help me with that? That's my process. That's also always been my process, just asking questions to the guys who know. And you know, they're they are questions coming from a non-technical guy. Like well, over the years, I've gotten more technical, of course. Over the years, having written all these articles, I understand more and more and more, and it gets easier to parse a new proposal because it's based on everything that's already out there. Mm-hmm. So over time, I'm getting more technical, but that's, you know, the process has always been the same. Just ask whatever I don't understand, try to explain it back to them until I do understand it. And that seems to work. Seems to work for me.
Works for me so far. Like reading your articles. Like, do you ever have any problem with, like, I mean, that's pretty awesome that pretty much everybody is available. And I mean, that's kind of one of the fascinating things about the internet is that just the access to everyone.
Right.
But do you ever have any issues with, like, people be like, I'm sorry, I just don't have the time right now to answer these questions? Like, or is everybody pretty much just like, yeah, like, let me correct you here kind of thing? Like, how's that?
Yeah, I almost never have these kinds of problems, surprisingly to me. Like, sometimes I feel almost like guilty for reaching out to some of these people because, you know, they're like the top talents in the world building the future. Like, they probably have something better to do or something that I would consider more important almost. But
yeah.
But no, they're almost always, like, without exception, just patient and willing. And it probably helps that I've been doing this for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I've sort of built a reputation where they hopefully know that if they take the time for me, then I will really try to get it right. And oftentimes people will also, you know, like the articles, read the articles, and therefore learn what these guys are doing, which is nice for them as well. You know, working with a small elite of top developers, I'm sure is fun, but it's also probably fun if a lot of people actually understand what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And appreciate that. So that may be their reward there. But no, they're surprisingly, or I don't know if it's surprising, but they're almost always patient and willing to help me out.
Cool. Yeah, you know? No doubt the having your reputation precede you probably makes it a whole lot easier. So no, everybody knows you're not trying to waste their time.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Hopefully.
All right, before we dive into some of the major developments that he's been writing about recently and the ones that he is most excited to see come to fruition in the protocol, let's take a quick break and hit our sponsor, and then we will jump right back in.
How long the Lightning Network series was one of the first ones that was the first of your technical pieces that I think that just blew my mind, because I had been trying to wrap my head around the Lightning Network and was having a really, really hard time because, I mean, that was just a really complex thing. How long did it take you to put that series together?
Oh, that's a great example, because I think that one took the longest out of all my technical explainer type of articles.
Really?
There were three articles, but I think it took me maybe 2 weeks, including the research, writing, and then we had to do all the drawings. And like, all in all, I think it took about 2 weeks for these three articles, which is definitely the longest I've worked on any technical article. That was also, that was difficult, man. Like you said, at that point in time, like, for context, the Lightning Network was this thing people would talk about. And it was this thing that, you know, it was on the Bitcoin Core roadmap, and it was a big deal in the scaling debate, and people kept mentioning the Lightning Network as a potential solution or part of a solution. But there was no clear explanation anywhere, right?
Yeah.
You had the white paper,
mm-hmm.
the Lightning white paper, of course, and then you had a couple of presentations by Joseph Poon and Tanch. Then the presentations maybe simplified it a little bit, but it was probably still going over most people's heads. And then Rusty Russell did an explainer series as well. He did a 3-part blog post where he tried to break it down. And that was already a big step compared to like the white paper. And it was already like Rusty Russell already really lowered the bar of required expertise to understand it all. But it was still pretty complex. So that was nothing for me to go off either. And I just decided one day, you know what? I'm going to tackle this thing. I want to tackle this Lightning Network, and I'm gonna explain this in a way that people can understand it, even though I have no idea myself how it actually works, or I don't really get it either. So I started doing that. So I started reading everything that was there, Rusty's blogs and watching the presentations and everything. And I think I may have also been asking questions to some of the developers. But I remember after like 2 full days of doing that, or maybe it was even 3 days, or like after, you know, too long, really, like at that point where I felt like I should have an article by now, I still had nothing. I was getting a bit stressed. Like, I don't know what I'm going to do anymore. I just don't get this. I'm not smart enough. So what I started doing is I started to draw it out. I just took a big piece of paper and a pen and I just literally started drawing out, and like a, you know, this is a transaction and I'll draw a clock and that's a time lock, and this is like a hash preimage, and I'll do it as a key, and I'll sort of, and I started drawing it out one step at a time, and that helps. And after a day of drawing or something, and you know, and still trying to wrap my head around it all, I finally felt like, okay, you know what? I think I kind of get it now. This makes sense, and this is pretty clever.
Yeah. So were those diagrams in the article? Were those yours? Yes. Like, essentially? Exactly. Wow.
I decided, okay, you know what? We're actually going to use these drawings. That's what we're going to do. So I asked the Bitcoin Magazine team, like, is this possible? Do we have someone who can make a nice drawing? I didn't make the computer graphic drawings. I made it in Paint, mm-hmm. and then mm-hmm. someone else made it like better. But they were essentially like I drew out the rough concept of it all, and these were actually the drawings I used myself. And then we sort of that through a phase or two, we turned that into the actual diagrams that are in the article. I still got a lot of help. I think Joseph Poon was definitely helping me out, Rusty as well. And, you know, just going back and forth, asking questions, making sure I got it right. And yeah, after 2 weeks, I had like a 3-part Lightning article and was finally able to explain it. And people seem to appreciate it. It's still to this day, what are we, like 3 years later, I think?
Mm-hmm. Around there.
Yeah, I think I published it in like 2016, spring, summer, something like that. And even mm-hmm. today, it's definitely one of the articles people will still bring up. Like, and it's been used in like university courses, I've heard. And
oh shit, really?
Yeah, it's been used in like all sorts of contexts that were way beyond what I ever intended. But it seemed to have really helped a lot of people to understand it. Like it kind of helped myself as well.
Yeah, yeah, it was definitely it was. Without a doubt, the one that finally got me to understand it. I think really being able to look at those diagrams, like the actual layout of the contract, because I'm much more of a visual learner in that way. And but I've had so many people I've had so many people tell me like, thank you for turning his thing into audio. Because like that was the thing that finally made me like understand what the hell Lightning was.
Really?
So
I was wondering about that. Yeah, I know you did read the articles on your mm-hmm. podcast, and I just can't imagine that for me personally, if someone would just read it to me, I don't think I would get it. Like I would actually need to see the drawings and go back in the text when I forgot something, but that works for people. Apparently.
There is definitely a subset that it works well in audio. And also I tried to, like afterward in the commentary,
I tried to explain the diagram or the contract that was in the diagram, and I explained it like a tree with three branches. Right. And so I tried to give a visual for them for what you had in the article. But I definitely had a lot of people say, that like, thank you for doing that series because like that made a big difference. Anybody that you have had say that, like, it works just as well in audio. Nice. Yeah. So with that, you've written about a ton of the stuff that's coming up soon, like a lot of the in development, like technology right now. In fact, have you written about L2? I have not seen one about that. Have you?
Last week.
You have written. Did you? I have not wrapped my head.
I think it's called, no, the article is, what is it called? Well, it's named after no.
You're talking about the no input script.
Yes, that's also about L2. Basically, it's because no input enables L2. So the article kind of explains both, actually.
Okay, good. I haven't jumped into that one. Well, that's not true. I've read like the first like four paragraphs and gotten really excited about it, but I haven't read it through. But that's probably the biggest one. L2, like how the key system works is when I tried to read it on the white paper, it was not doing anything for me. But with that, with the no input like scripts, these new scripts, the state chains, Schnorr, you've written about a number of different privacy technologies, Graphroot, Taproot, all of this stuff, and the huge set of tools that are like happening with the Lightning Network. What right now is the most compelling to you? Like, what do you think will be the most impactful kind of from like your investigation, like side of things?
I think Taproot's going to be a big deal. I think that's
really,
I think it's really awesome. I really mm-hmm. like that you can turn all sorts of complex smart contract type of things into just regular looking Bitcoin transactions. I think that, you know, you're looking at a blockchain and you don't know if someone just sent someone else money or whether they opened and closed the Lightning channel. There's just no way to know the difference. And I think that's really cool. I think that's good for privacy and fungibility, and we need that. So I really like that. And it's it's gonna be combined with Schnorr. It's a really really neat concept, I think. Just hiding all the complexity and make it all look normal. That's a good idea if you ask me. I really like that one. In general, I really hope we can get as much privacy as possible. Of course, like that's the main challenge I think we have before us the next couple of years. It also, I'm sometimes a little bit worried that as Bitcoin continues to grow and as more and more people are entering the space, I'm a little bit concerned that maybe privacy isn't as high a priority for a lot of people. And some people might even prefer Bitcoin to have this level of transparency to please regulators. And that's a bit concerning. I really hope we can, you know, start. Well, we have been making pretty good progress on the privacy front in the last year or two, mm-hmm. especially since the scaling wars kind of ended. It seems that developers have been able to focus on privacy a bit more. So that's making progress. Also, you know, we have with Wasabi, for example, which is actually a pretty good privacy wallet. That's great to have that. I hope we can, and Taproot's part of that, and I hope we will see as much as possible. The other thing I really like is, for example, what's it called again? Maybe you remember the name. It's when, let's say I make a payment to you, and you actually contribute mm-hmm. one of the inputs. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. The one where like I would add my like a change. Oh, what was that? Is that Stonewall? No.
Not quite.
No, that's not the one.
I should remember.
I know what you're talking about. It's like a little mini coin join type thing.
Yeah. I think that would be so cool if we see that implemented in some wallets. Let's say it's implemented in Electrum or something. I don't know if they have been doing that or plans or anything like that. But Electrum does, I don't know, maybe 10% of all Bitcoin transactions, like a good chunk. And if you'd have something like that in something like Electrum, that would make such a big difference. It would just completely mess up blockchain analytics so badly that would be really great. It would just break so many of their assumptions. I'm really hoping we could see something like that, which is totally feasible. Like, it's possible. It does complicate making a transaction a little bit because both parties need to be online. So there are drawbacks, but if we could make something like that happen, even if it's just 1% of transactions, even if it's just, you know, it doesn't have to be 90%. Like, it needs to be a nice share where it's enough to break the assumption in a pretty consistent way. That would be neat. I really hope we can see something like that. So yeah, in general, I'm hoping privacy and fungibility. That's just the main thing. That's the main challenge. Right,
that's now, the main concern. Yeah, that's interesting because Taproot, Taproot does have I love that. Like, that's kind of because it's kind of a bit of compression of the data and privacy at the same time, which is, I'm loving that those technologies are kind of going hand in hand. Same with Schnorr signatures, is that you're at the same time that you're getting data savings, which is critical for making good use of the block space, you're getting privacy kind of by default with these technologies. And excuse me, I have to say I am pleasantly surprised because I had a couple of conversations right after, sometime in 2017, so about 2 years ago-ish, when it was kind of clear that the block size wars were kind of on their way out, you know, like we were finally at least breaking up and being okay with it, that I thought the next major battle was going to be privacy. And I guess I'm pleasantly surprised that it doesn't seem to be much of a battle. Like, everybody's, like, a lot of the development and stuff seems to be focused on it and moving in that direction, which is really exciting. But I don't feel like the huge fight, and maybe we're not there yet, but do you think it's going to be like a big, like, tussle when we kind of get there?
I think part of the reason that it's not really there yet is that we don't have really good privacy solutions yet. Well, they're coming now, but you know, it always takes a while for regulation to catch up. There are even today pretty, if they would want to attack privacy, they could be too successful for comfort, you know. Who knows? Maybe exchanges at some point will refuse CoinJoin transactions, or Bitcoin coins that have a history with the CoinJoin a few steps back, or who knows what kind of attacks are possible. But I'm definitely not comfortable with what we have today. Really, I am hopeful for what will be possible. But I don't think the technical solution is solving it all. And I'm not sure that will. I think part of the solution will also just be regulators and society at large will have to accept that we're going to claim privacy. We're not gonna, you know, and that's also a social battle. Like, it's not just a technological thing. It's not enough to have a technical solution alone. I think we need to spread this idea that privacy is all right. It's a human right. It's something we're allowed to have. And only if, I think that's part of the puzzle. Like, it needs to be accepted that we're going to have privacy.
Yeah, and I think
it would be great if we could just have a technical solution that fixes it all. But unfortunately, I think that's probably not gonna cut it.
Yeah, I kind of agree that it has to be, like, we kind of have to basically, like, I don't know, I guess put our foot down and say, well, we're not really asking permission, you know?
Yeah.
But that's why I'm really happy with things like Taproot. Dandelion is another good one, even though it seems pretty basic and it's just like in actually sending messages out to the network. And Schnorr, that, like, by default, and Lightning is another good example, like, that by default, the cheaper option is the one that gives privacy because it's compressing the data, so that you kind of have like a backup argument. Yeah. It's like, well, why are you using this privacy technique? It's like, well, because it saves me 75% on my fee to, you know, join in with these other 10 people in a transaction and make a Schnorr signature kind of thing. Like, so the fact that the economic incentives are aligned, it's like, not only are we taking your privacy, but we're forcing you to pay more for the same service. It creates a dual pushback against that kind of regulation. So I'm hoping, I got fingers crossed that becomes like that ends up going hand in hand with pushing for better privacy. Do you think that's kind of that is the biggest challenge? Like, even in the, like, legal regulatory stuff, like the scaling limitations and, you know, maybe the frustration with Lightning, you know, not being the perfectest solution that we could have. Is it really just privacy, you think, is kind of the big barrier right now?
It's the one I care about the most.
Okay.
I mean, there are all sorts of challenges out there, but privacy is the one I care about the most. And it's also, I think part of it is also that I think it has the most urgency. Like, we need to get this now. Like, you can't really, you can have privacy on at higher levels, but it's good to have it on the protocol level as well. And like I said, I kind of feel that the door is closing on that one. I don't know if it's how open it still is. Like, we probably still have time, but at some point it's going to get harder to actually accomplish it. So it has the priority for me. And then other problems, there are other challenges, but I feel like these have less urgency if you ask me
personally. Gotcha. Yeah. I'm pretty much with you there. Like, it's really we got to do it now or we might lose our opportunity. And that could spell a big difference between, you know, going down the road 10 years as to what we have at our disposal and kind of the default of, it's kind of like the internet, you know, like when you're trying to get your privacy back and by default for the last 20 years, it's not been there. Well, then the question is, why do you want privacy, as opposed to if there was privacy or, you know, everything was encrypted by default? The question would be, why do you want to invade my privacy?
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
So, yeah. Speaking of privacy, I mentioned the Genesis Files series that you did some time back. Do you think that you have written about Satoshi, like one of those, like Wei Dai, Adam Back, Nick Szabo, like everybody that you've covered in the cypherpunks, do you think one of them was Satoshi, or do you think it's an outsider that kind of hadn't played his hand yet?
I don't know. I wish. Well, I don't, would I wish I knew? I don't even know if I would wish I knew.
Yeah.
But I just don't know. They're definitely candidates for sure. Like, Nick Szabo is definitely a candidate. Adam Back, in my book, is also a candidate. Wei Dai has been a bit quiet, but I guess as well. I mean, they're candidates, or they're like candidates to be part of a team. But I've been reading a lot of cypherpunk archives, and while reading it, I realized that, you know, there are actually more candidates that we've just never heard of. Like, there were more people involved with some of these discussions, and there were more people that had some pretty good ideas or that we're definitely thinking about. I mean, I've read proposals that really sort of foreshadow Bitcoin in ways, or you could say, I mean, so did something like BitGold, of course, but there were more ideas along these lines of just people we've, you know, that haven't reached the level of fame as the Adam Becks and Nick Szabos have reached. I definitely think it's also possible that just one of these people that we don't mention every week or every day, or that are never mentioned in this context, that are just, that could have been it, that could have been them. I don't have any names present for you, and I don't know if that would be interesting in the first place, but yeah, reading through these archives definitely made me realize that it's not just four candidates. They're probably more like, you know, 20, 30 candidates, these people that were thinking about this stuff and that probably had the ability to build something like that.
Interesting. Yeah, I think I would probably be devastated if we actually found out who it was. Like, I don't really want to know who Satoshi is, but I love to speculate.
Yeah, but I think that's why we don't want to know, so we can still speculate, and that's fine.
Exactly. So you're digging into some cypherpunk archives. Where was it just the mailing list? Like, you just like reading through the mailing list back?
Yeah, that would have been mostly it. Mailing list archives. Yep.
Are you working on something outside of Bitcoin Magazine with this? Is this?
Yeah. I'd like to write a book. I'd like to write a book on, or I am writing a book, I should say. The process is in motion. I'd like to. So the Genesis Files was sort of first steps into that type of research. But there, especially as I've been doing more research, I've come to realize that the Genesis Files was pretty limited. Actually, there's a lot that I missed, I guess you could say. You know, to name one example, I think I remember when I wrote the Hashcash article, I think I wrote something like that there weren't a lot of people who responded to the proposal. And now that I've been doing more research, I've realized, oh man, I just missed it. Like, there were whole threads about it just under a different name or like in different contexts. It wasn't as obvious that the thread was about Hashcash, but there was actually tons of discussion about it. I sort of missed that. So at some point I'll probably revise these articles as well a little bit, or add something, or I don't know. But I'd like to turn it all into a book.
Nice. That would be awesome. I would be your first. If you want me to be a beta reader, I'll be a beta reader, but I will be a, if you ever get through that, I know how books can be, because I've got one in perpetuity right now as well.
Yeah. it's a lot of work, man.
Yes, I realized
that as well, especially like the research, just the research alone. It's a lot of work. So I've been, that's why I've been taking some time off from Bitcoin Magazine. So I'm just focusing on this writing and research projects.
If you get it done, let me know ASAP, because I will buy your first copy, hands down, hand over my heart.
Well done.
So I want to, before we get to the end of this, I wanted to hit one thing, because you actually, like, I like that you actually mentioned the whole printing press thing at the beginning, and how like that was kind of what brought you to Bitcoin, was its element in kind of changing the game, you know, like that paradigm shift idea. And journalism is in a really interesting place right now. Like, you know, we're in the age of fake news, as it's being called, I guess. For trying to find something in the mainstream, like, that's true about Bitcoin, that's like accurate, is really, really, it's just not. I have to admit, it's getting better, but it's been really a garbage take every single time. And So outside of just you doing your research and figuring out what the truth is and writing about that, do you think there's some specific cause to this? Is this just like some big transition that's happening between, like, you know, maybe the internet versus, you know, the old mainstream? Like, what's kind of your take on the state of the industry right now for journalism?
Journalism is having to reinvent itself, and that's not so easy, because for decades or centuries, people would pay for their news, right? People would walk to the store and buy a newspaper or they'll buy a magazine. So people would buy their news, and that's kind of gone away since the internet. Paywalls aren't really working. I mean, there are some exceptions here and there, but it's not really working. So it's all kind of drifted to this ad model. But that's, first of all, that really changes the incentives, because when you want people to buy your stuff, there's a much stronger incentive to produce something of quality that people want to buy. You know, if they read your magazine and they like it, they think it's valuable, they'll maybe buy it again next time. While with the internet, it's drifted way more to just attracting attention to get that click. So quality, I mean, I'm not saying quality is completely unimportant, but it's definitely gotten less important overall in favor of just quantity, attracting attention. That's a problem. So there's a lot of, like, people like to critique journalism and journalists these days, but the same people are often not willing to pay for it in the first place. So it's, you know, it's kind of, yeah, you're right that it's not very, that the quality isn't very high, but you're also getting it for free and you're not willing to pay for anything. So, yeah. You know,
Admittedly, I haven't paid for it. Every time I run into a paywall, I'm like, ugh. Well, I mean, usually it's because I have to sign up, yeah. Though. Like, I feel like maybe if it was like a one time, like I pay 10 cents to get the article, I might actually do it. Maybe. I don't know.
Maybe.
I don't know.
And I think more likely that you'd still not do it. At least.
It's very possible. Yeah. It's possible.
I think paywalls in the internet is just a bad match. It doesn't, like, it would have to be so seamless, in the same sense that, I don't know, maybe something like Spotify, or like where you pay like a monthly, you know, $10 and then you can read everything. Maybe something like that would work. And then when I mean everything, I mean everything. I don't mean one particular outlet. I mean, just read whatever you want. Like, maybe something like that would work. And there's some attempts at that. And there's experimentation all around, but I think it's a difficult problem to solve, and I really do think that's a problem. I think you know, if there's not a lot of money to be made, then talented people will prefer to do something else where they can make more money. So a lot of talented people just don't want to become a journalist anymore. And even talented people, if they just have to write clickbait, you know, that's doesn't benefit anyone. I really think that's the core of the problem. How are we monetizing content in this digital age? And if we figure out a good solution there, I think quality will return as well. And it's not as if quality disappeared entirely, but in general, it will definitely improve quality.
Gotcha. Yeah, because I think, like, for just kind of like my perspective, I don't really do like a lot of hunting into like the state of journalism. It's just kind of like this thing that I'm curious about because it is changing so much right now. But I feel like there's this, particularly on the internet, there's this dichotomy between kind of these like trust-based like relationships, like guerrilla journalism, where like people are straight up boots on the ground and doing their own stuff. And like, you're following somebody on like a podcast or like some YouTube show. And like, that's just what they do. But then there's this huge, massive, just kind of like clickbait thing. at the same time. So how do you think, like, as far as like trying to get incentives aligned for paying for content or paying for good news, how do you think Bitcoin plays a role in that? Like whether it could or has empowered people like the WikiLeaks or whistleblowers in general for, you know, getting the truth out there, just having it available. How do you think Bitcoin kind of changes the game or influences journalism?
Yeah, well, that's a great example. If you're in some kind of regime where journalists aren't as safe as they are in the Netherlands or the United States, probably, you know, if you're in Russia, if you're in, you know, name a country where like most of the world probably actually. And if you can perform journalism anonymously and then your payments happen in Bitcoin, like that's hugely empowering. So for that, it could be great if people are willing to pay for journalism in the first place, of course. But then yeah, Bitcoin definitely offers a solution there. Maybe it will offer a solution in the micropayments kind of sphere. This is definitely something the cypherpunks expected in the 90s. This was before the ad-based model sort of took over. They definitely expected that this is how it would work. People pay 10 cents for articles. I'm kind of skeptical that will work, but it would be great if it did work. So maybe it's worth experimenting with, and maybe Bitcoin can or Lightning and can play a role there. It would be neat. It would be great. It would be amazing. But I think for now, until that's really invented or proven to work, the other example is probably more powerful. Just being able to take payments anonymously in a country where that matters.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yes. My thing about the whole paywall stuff is that I can't decide when I do use it, because I've absolutely paid more Lightning paywalls than I've ever paid for like a subscription to get a New York Times or whatever it is. But I can't tell if I'm doing it because I just want to play around with Lightning or if I would actually pay to read the article. You know what I mean?
Exactly, yeah.
So we'll see. We'll see as that goes forward, if there's like something where, as Nick Notzabo says, we minimize consumer worry enough that it feels seamless to get to the article for 10 cents. Like it's just, maybe it's just a click, do you agree kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll see. I got my fingers crossed that we'll figure something out.
Well, I think Notzabo would say the opposite, right? Like he thinks that the mental cost is too much already, like just having to think about whether you want to pay for this article or not.
That's what I'm meaning, is maybe we'll get it down low enough that it won't be the barrier.
Right.
The minimizing consumer worry, because that really kind of turned me away and made me go, oh man, micropayments might just not work. Because he has really, that was a really good piece by him. So
yeah. And I who else wrote about that? What would Google do? The author of that, he also made that argument. What's his name again? Anyway, he writes about journalism and internet and that sort of stuff. So Jarvis.
Jarvis, what was the article? I'd like to dig into it. Maybe add it in my list at least.
What would Google do? It's a book.
What would Google? Oh, it's a good book. What would Google do? Okay.
And
that's interesting. I don't know that one. Yeah, I'll definitely check
Jeff
it out.
Jeff Jarvis, he wrote about that kind of stuff as well, and he also makes that argument that just forcing people to think about whether they want to pay or not is already too much.
Yeah.
Like that, the difference,
you've gone
difference
far.
Even between 0 and 1 cent is just a huge difference already, because you're forcing people to think about whether they want to pay, and that's already a huge hurdle, more so than the money.
Well, with that, we're coming to the end here. So what do you think? I'd love to hear your opinion on what is the most significant change that in the next 10 years that Bitcoin will bring us? Like, what do you see? What's your future that you think is most significant?
Wow, great question. The main thing that got me interested in Bitcoin, or the first sort of real use case I saw for this, just a hedge against the financial system. Smuck insurance, I think. Was it Bilal that called it that?
I don't know. I don't. It sounds familiar, but I don't know who.
Yeah, like if the whole thing does collapse, or if we do see some sort of major financial catastrophic event like hyperinflation or something like that, then Bitcoin is actually going to perform as a safe haven. It's right there. A lot of people, even people that don't think about Bitcoin in that way, they're just speculating for money, or they're just buying drugs. Like, even they will have, you know, they have Bitcoin wallets on their phones. They know how it works. And when the shit hits the fan, they're going to know. You know, they're going to know how to use it. And I think that, I don't know if it's going to happen, but if it happens, like, Bitcoin is there. And it's going to help a lot of people. It's already doing that in some place in the world, of course. But I think that's the biggest deal about Bitcoin.
Got you. Yeah. It's definitely, I think I'm kind of leaning towards the fact that it will just be a sovereign debt crisis will really be the big thing that kicks it off. But yeah, the fact that Bitcoin is there kind of as an escape valve for all that pressure, is just fascinating in itself, because we've never had it before. Like, we've never really had a way out. Like, gold was kind of the best, not that great of an option, essentially. So
yeah, and well, yeah, gold was the best option, and then they banned it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I don't think they're going to be able to ban Bitcoin. Well, I mean, you know what I mean. They can ban it by law, but that's not going to stop people from having it on their computers.
Exactly. When you ban gold, you're banning it in the same layer, in the physical layer, in which you kind of have control. So they're banning it, basically bans it. Like, there's, you know, going to be stuff that leaks through the crack. But when you ban Bitcoin, you don't really put up many barriers. You just kind of, you squeeze the on ramps and off ramps. So yeah, I agree. Like, it's not really going to stop Bitcoin. It's just going to make it a little bit more of a headache. with that in that 10 years, when all this is coming to a head and we see what's going on, are you still going to be around writing about all the cool new tech and breaking down the white papers for me?
I think so. I think so. I think Bitcoin is still, I still think it's super fascinating. But that's also because it's developing fast and it's growing fast. And that's part of the fascination. Maybe at some point, if I feel it's kind of stagnating, if it's not really growing anymore, and if there's not that many new developments, or then I might get bored and just find the new thing that interests me. That's definitely possible. I mean, 10 years is a long time. I don't know. But right now, I don't have any. I will say I'm thinking I would like to do some other types of media as well, probably. So writing is definitely something I see myself doing for a while, but I think I would enjoy doing some other stuff. I'm gonna do a podcast soon as well, actually.
No kidding.
Yeah, well, it's gonna be a Dutch podcast. It's gonna be okay. Yeah, with two other Bitcoiners here in the Netherlands. One of them.
Well, now I have to learn Dutch.
Yeah. Well, we'll probably do like an English spin-off thing maybe as well, where if there's like English guests or something.
All right, I'll keep an eye out for it.
Yeah, we're planning on doing that. We're probably gonna start after summer, and then we'll there isn't really a Bitcoin only podcast in the Netherlands yet. There are a couple of like crypto podcasts that focus on like everything, like blockchain and every altcoin, and you know, Bitcoin will be featured once in a while, but we're gonna do like a Bitcoin only podcast, and I'm looking forward to that. I think that will be fun.
Sweet.
So that's one thing. I mentioned the book, so that's kind of a different media as well. And who knows, 10 years, a long time.
Happens in 10 years. 10 years document. Bitcoin didn't exist.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I'll only be writing or maybe my function at Bitcoin Magazine will change over time. Maybe I'll do something else at Bitcoin Magazine, or I don't know. I think I'll still do Bitcoin stuff for years to come. As long as I find Bitcoin interesting, I'll do Bitcoin stuff. And I still find Bitcoin interesting. And I think it will be interesting for a while longer. I don't know if it will be writing articles only. I know it won't be articles only because I'm doing a podcast. But yeah, who knows? I would enjoy doing more diverse stuff probably.
That's exciting. I'll be waiting on the doorstep to check it all out. With that, is there anything else you want to mention? And I would also say, for like the recent stuff that you've been writing, and on the website, in the magazine, anything, if you could tell, my listeners to read one that was really good, what would it be?
I guess of my more recent articles, I would say go and read the Taproot one. I think that's a big upgrade that's coming, hopefully, potentially. It's not there yet. We'll still have to go through the whole activation process and everything like that. And it's not even clear what that's gonna look like, but it looks promising. Like it looks like it's gonna happen. Taproot's a big deal. I think my article came out pretty well too. So I guess that would be my recommendation.
Cool. Awesome. Well, dude, thank you for coming on the show. Sorry about your headset not working, but I think it sounds good. It sounds good. So no issues there, I don't think, but
all right.
I really appreciate you coming on the show. Like I said, I've been following you for ages, it seems. And, I'll be excited to see the next one when you drop a new article.
All right. Thanks for having me.
All right, man. Yeah, man. And say hey to everybody at the Bitcoin Magazine crew for me.
All right. Take care.
All right, dude. Take it easy.
And that will do it for today. Do not forget to check out the many articles that we have read of Aaron's on the show. I'll drop a lot of those links in the show notes if I can find them all. I don't even know how many pieces we've done. Most recently, the one we talked about was State Chains. And I'm also going to link to all the work he has done on Bitcoin Magazine, as well as the most recent print article, the 10th anniversary edition. So you'll be able to find all that stuff in the show notes and obviously his Twitter page so that you can follow him and you don't miss the other amazing stuff he's always, always writing about and talking about. Like I know I said in the show how like I really have come to depend on him because I don't quite have the time to really dig into some of these things when, you know, I have so much other stuff to read. So I've been relying on him a lot and I really, really appreciate his work. So thank you all for joining me. This is The Crypto Economy, and I am Guy Swan. If you want to hear all about the crazy tech, all the different perspectives, and want to consume as much of the incredible writing and content available in this space, then this is the place you need to be. Don't forget to subscribe on your favorite app, whether it be iTunes or Spotify or SoundCloud, wherever you are. Don't forget to subscribe to the show and, of course, follow me on Twitter at The Crypto Economy and Aaron as well at Aaron Van W. And until next time, take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.